Hello and welcome to the Armin Show podcast, science, people, creativity, learning more. I always mention learning more, and in this case, we were specifically talking about learning more, which is nice. And my guest today is Scott Young. He was on in 2019 for his previous book, Ultra Learning. He has a new book, Get Better at Anything, 12 Maxims for Mastery. Scott H. Young, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm glad to have you back on. I've checked your material across many, many years. Even from your blog long ago to your book, to your current book. So it's very cool to see the trajectory. And you're very sharp, always in the learning category.
Oh, thank you.
Which information has always been big to me. And so that speaks to that, how to learn memory, thoughts, and things like that.
Yeah.
What prompts this book in differentiation from ultra learning? What causes you to go into this direction?
Yeah. Why? So, I mean, the book... and ultra learning, they're both kind of birds of a feather in the sense that they're both about, like, how do you learn? How do you get better? But the focus of ultra learning was a little narrower. I was more interested in, you know, these sort of impressive people who were taking on these really difficult, intensive, self-directed learning projects. And the story that I think kicked off writing this book was the one that I open with, which is talking about Tetris. And Tetris may seem like a funny topic for learning. I mean, you know, I go on some of these podcasts and you talk about video games and people are like, what do you mean, like learning to get good at video games? But it really, I think, in a nutshell, kind of summarizes many of the difficulties and opportunities that we have with learning. And so this sort of fun little fact is that people have, you know, Tetris has been out since the early 90s, but it's only been in like the last decade that people have gotten really good at it. So if you look at like the people who are the best in the world, you know, the leaderboards of the top Tetris players, it was for about 20 years, the scores were, you know, like not that good compared to what we can do today. And now there's like 12, 13-year-old kids who can do things that would have been seen as impossible 20 years ago. And the difference is that now the environment's changed. Now there's the internet. Now you can learn from other people. Now you can watch someone playing the game, see exactly what they're doing with their hands, exactly what strategies they're using. And this ability to learn from others means that, well, now not just are individual players getting better, but the entire sort of field as a whole is progressing. And this has a lot of interesting parallels, you know, with things like the development of science, you know, company cultures and the ability to innovate. And so the thing that I think kind of really kicked off this book was that I was interested in this kind of story where it's not really about an individual person, not about, you know, oh, so-and-so is so impressive or so smart, but about what are the basic ingredients that go into getting better at things and how can we accomplish that? And so the Tetris story to me was really sort of about something even more basic, not really about, you know, any of the individual players, but about the sort of how the environment enables or inhibits in some cases learning and progress.
I've always enjoyed that video games are connected to learning. They're one of the first things that kids go towards when they are trying to showcase, oh, I'm picking up something rapidly. Tetris has always been popular. I have so many remixes of the Tetris melody song that I've listened to over the years. I've always enjoyed, which is neat. Now, I'm in the creative space. You are a creator.
Mm-hmm.
You talk a bit about creativity in the book, and that's a big category of my interest. How would you describe the connection between creativity and learning?
Yeah. So, I mean, creativity is a really interesting field. I have like a couple chapters which touch on it in the book. And I think getting kind of a grasp on creativity is often hard because we sort of talk about it in these sort of mysterious terms. You know, even you can pick up books off the shelf where people talk about it like it's essentially magic. And I don't think that at all. I don't think creativity is magic at all. I think it's totally explainable in terms of the cognitive processes that underline a lot of other skills. And so I talk about it in a few different contexts in the book, but in one context, which I think is very important, is that we often neglect how much creativity is built on sort of understanding and copying sort of successful examples that come before us that I think, especially in Western culture, we've sort of set up this dichotomy that like you can be creative or you can be a copyist. And like those are two different things. And, you know, they are in tension or they're pulling away from each other. Whereas I try to make the argument here that there's quite a bit of evidence that it's actually a progressive sequence, that you start off by copying, you start off by observing and like seeing what other people are doing. And then your creative efforts tend to be sort of a mashup or flipping of some of the ideas that you previously learned into a new form. And so I think, you know, there's some interesting cognitive science research about how we learn, how we progress in skills that I think very much applies to this. John Sweller's work with cognitive load theory is one of the things that I talk about in the book, which I think gives this this sort of notion that we are really building out of previous tools that we've acquired elsewhere. I think gives some real scientific heft to that idea.
I like this concept very much because I've talked about this in terms of relationships, how it's good to have a backlog before building a relationship on top of that. Same thing with content, having, let's say, journal entries over the years, or having your ideas and thoughts put out there, some sort of base of creativity or effort or writings. And then from that, you can go somewhere that you could not have gone if that was not there from scratch. There's a real strength to the base,
that I believe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Without that, it would all... it'll crumble, I would say. Now, in terms of creativity and making content, there can be times where our victories happen and it is positive. But at the same time, there can be difficulties in life or errors that are made. Mm-hmm. I thought this one was interesting because I've seen so many times that failure is where you learn the most from. And you have a theme that represents the opposite, that something like... majority should be success,
and
a small amount of failure to learn from, which is the opposite of the learn from failure dynamic. Can you describe that?
Well, so I think the advice that like failure is the best teacher, that we learn from our mistakes, is, you know, it comes from a good place. It's certainly the case that I think there are places where you need to have corrective feedback, and certainly you can't, you know, like unless you were just born perfectly proficient at a skill, you're not going to just like go out and do it and you're not going to make any mistakes. So I think in that sense, you know, the failure is a good teacher. You need failure in these kinds of things. There's some wisdom embodied in that. So I don't want to be totally dismissive of that idea. But where I think it's a bit of a stretch and where I think it's sort of underrated is that we often neglect how much early formative experiences and not having the right foundation, both in terms of the cognitive skills and in terms of like the early positive experiences, how much that influences not only your development of the skill itself, like do you have the building blocks to move up to make progress, but also if you don't have those early positive experiences, often you just short circuit your motivation. And then the result is that you don't keep going, you don't keep progressing in that field. And so, you know, it sounds maybe like this is the contrary point to the contrary point, so I'm back to an obvious point, but to me I think that is also worth underscoring, that like when we're starting out in a field as teachers, we want to be creating environments where we can see, you know, our students, our kids, our employees, we want to see them succeed so they can build that motivation, start building those skills. But even when we're approaching skills ourselves, we want to look at like, how can I build up a successful foundation for what I'm doing? And I think that, you know, there's a lot of research. I cover the research in particular on learning to read, because this is one of the more well-studied aspects where this has been proven time and time again to be true. But it applies across many different domains, that if you want to get good at a skill, building up that foundation of success is very important. And then when you're successful and you're doing things well, then occasional mistakes and failures and pushing through obstacles and building grit and determination, those things do come in play later. But I think very much in the beginning, we want to be building from success.
I have noticed that over the years, you have learned quite a bit in very many domains, languages, computer science, and maybe programming, a lot of the knowledge over the years. And so, but you also have a sense of the first steps of learning. So it's like you have all the parts in place. How do you keep sharp on what it's like to start learning something from scratch when you've learned so many things over time?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's one of the things that I've tried to do more, is to go into new skills and go into things where I don't have much background and And I think like that, I think helps keep you fresh in sort of your understanding of how learning works. I think one of the sort of downsides, particularly for people who specialize in kind of academic research related to learning, is that you go so deep in your understanding of the skill that even if you can, you know, do experiments and work with kids and this kind of stuff, you know, you don't have that visceral firsthand experience necessarily of being a beginner, or it's been a long time in the past. So I do think learning new things is important to get that kind of real experience of it. And I mean, that's something that I try to do with, you know, maintaining a lot of broad interests and trying out new skills, trying out new hobbies, is to, you know, get that back to zero feeling so that, you know, the theories that you'd kind of worked on that you sort of like, okay, if I do this again, how would I learn it? You get a chance to try it out again. And so that's been a major part of my life.
If there was an average person today, would you, if you wanted to get them started learning something well, mm-hmm. would you have them go towards something they were interested in learning? Or are there a few domains where you'd say, start here and then maybe apply it to something you need to learn or want to learn after that?
Yeah, I mean, I would always advise people to start with what they're most interested in learning, because, you know, outside of a few narrow situations, I think people have a really hard time putting in the energy to learn something when there isn't a lot of intrinsic interest. So sometimes in a situation, if there's a lot of external pressure, people can grind through something that they don't have much interest in. Like, you know, we all reflect on those classes we took in school that maybe we didn't have any interest in, but we like managed to get through. But I mean, if we're talking about the context of, all right, well, no one's forcing you to do this, no one's got a gun to your head to do this, then I find it's often the case that even the things that we are really interested in, we do have a lot of intrinsic interest, it's still not enough to, you know, overcome all the inertia of daily life and this kind of thing. So I always recommend people start with what they're interested in. But I think, again, this motivational dynamic that I talk about in the book is that, well, what you're interested in, what you're curious about is not static. It's not like you have, well, I'm born with three interests and those are going to be my interests forever. No, it's this changing process, this changing from experience. So as you learn things, as you build up more self-efficacy and confidence, then the things that feel like, okay, maybe I could tackle this, maybe if I did this, it would be fun, they expand a little bit, they generalize a little bit. And so start with the things you're super interested in. And then as you see success with them, the things that you're interested in start to expand, and the things that you're curious about start to expand. And so that's my advice for anyone learning things, is that if you feel like, you know what, I'm not interested in 99% of things, I say, great, focus on that 1% of things that you are interested in and use that little kernel to like expand outward and maybe develop some interest that, you know, maybe you wouldn't have thought about initially, but after you have some success with some skills or some subjects, you become more interested.
Expands outward from that region. How does someone know that they are learning well, or that they are in a, like when you're exercising, you're at a certain beats per minute of your heart, so that's a good exercise zone. How do you know you're in that learning zone?
Well, I mean, I think it is hard to know exactly. I think there's obviously the extremes where you have, you know, you have extreme frustration, or like you're not getting something, or you're trying something over and over and over again and you're not getting it. The difficulty level's too high. And then at the same time, I think where the difficulty level is probably too easy is when you're doing something over and over again, you're getting more and more comfortable doing it, but you are not making, you know, you're not making much progress into the harder versions of the tasks or the other, you know, sort of more advanced situations. So I think it just depends on the situation. It's hard to like come up with an exact rule. One idea that had come up a few times in research was this 80% or 85% rule, which is that you want to be succeeding about 80 to 85% of the time. Now, I did not end up actually including this rule when I was writing the book, because it seemed to be one of those things that could easily be like misapplied to different situations, where it's like, oh, well, Scott said it's 80%, so I'm going to use that as my benchmark. But like, you know, if you're doing heart surgery, you want a much more than 80% success rate. Like if you're flying a fighter jet, you don't want to be like, oh, crash 20% of the time. That's way too difficult, you know? So I think that, but I think for like a lot of, you know, especially academic type of material, going for about like, okay, I'm doing the problem sets, I'm getting 80 to 85% right, is probably about the zone you want to be in for maximizing learning. Anything that's much below that is usually you're encountering some difficulties and frustrations that it's probably better off trying to repair those, better off working on things that will build up that knowledge, you know, getting support, getting tutoring, getting coaching. And if it's much higher than that, then, well, again, if it depends on the task that you're working on. If your only goal is to just do something very efficiently, very quickly, then, you know, practicing when you're 100% successful is still good. It makes you faster and more efficient. But if your goal was to expand to more difficult types of tasks, more complicated situations, then you probably want to be progressing when it's more, a little bit more difficult there as well.
This makes sense. You want to have the difficulty hit a sweet spot as described in your material. Now, one thing that comes to mind is, how do you build the framework where it's a part of your daily life, you're regularly learning versus you do it for a month and that was your only month of the year that you learned a lot of things,
yeah,
and it's not part of your daily existence? How do you make it a thing? Because maybe you learned something and you learned that category, now you got it, so
yeah,
that puts an end on that, but you want to keep your mind sharp.
I tend to, like, even in my own writing, I tend to talk about this sort of tension between like habits and projects. So habits being the kind of thing that you do every single day, or, you know, on a routine basis that is maybe contributing to your improvement and growth, and projects being sort of a defined period of time where you have a very specific goal that you're working under. And, you know, it's not routine. It's not just like you're doing the same thing every day. You're doing something a little different. And I tend to think, you know, habits get kind of a little bit more of the sort of rosy press these days. And I think there are a lot of things in your life that making them habitual, making them automatic is very important. And learning can be one of those things. I mean, having a regular reading habit, for instance, can be very valuable. And that's sort of a habit that fuels learning, but is not sort of content specific. But I also tend to warn a little bit against trying to take that habit model maybe sometimes too far, because for a lot of skills, particularly skills where maybe the thing that you're trying to learn requires some upfront investment, it requires some sort of effort or planning or sort of goal-directed activity, having a more project-based model, I think, is more suitable. So if I were like, I've never done any programming and I want to learn to program, I would treat it as a project. I don't think the idea of like, well, I'm going to do 10 minutes of programming every day is like a good way to get that started. Now, it might be a good way to keep going if it was like, okay, I'm already a programmer, I want to just like stay fresh, so I'm going to do one of the like programming puzzles on an online website every day. I think that's okay. Same with learning a language. When people are starting out learning a language, I almost always recommend, well, you want to have some sort of committed period of time where you're going to get to a level where, okay, maybe you can do the things that you want to do. And then if you want to maintain it after, picking some sort of low effort in the background habits better. But I feel like when you start out, I'm not as big a fan of that approach, because you can very easily get yourself involved in activities which are maybe like only minimally helpful for making progress, but it's still like you're doing something every day. And then that, I think, can be sometimes a distraction.
The valid point there. I always think about creation versus consumption in the category of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
I like to stay on the creation side when possible, because I always think that consumption, it can be done by almost anybody, but creation is your element to that. What would you say about creation versus consumption in learning? How much of learning can be related to consuming material information, and how much of learning is associated with you putting out effort or creating or putting energy upon it?
Well, I mean, I think they're both very important. So, you know, as I talk about with the Tetris example, and I reference in many times, much of what we know comes from other people. So in a certain sense, like, we are not, you know, living on a desert island having to invent society from scratch. We are cultural species. We absorb things from around us. And I think often we do this so automatically, so reflexively that we don't even realize we're doing it. You know, you don't even realize like how much of what you're saying is just kind of almost the regurgitated opinion of someone else who said something similar, just because that's how our brains work and that's what we do. So I think in one sense, you know, consumption is very important to creativity because it gives you the sort of raw material available from the culture for solving new problems, for creating new things. But I also think what you're saying is correct, that, you know, like you can watch a lot of TV shows and not be a good showrunner for a TV show. Like you can, you know, go to the museum and look at a lot of Van Gogh paintings and not paint like him. And so there is a certain amount that you need to do the skill as well in order to take those sort of suggestions or raw ideas and build them into real skills. So they're both very important. I think it depends on what the concrete situation we're talking about like where it's going to be more important. I think there's certainly some places where, you know, there's lots of people who know a lot about it or they know a lot about the skill, but they don't do enough practice. But I think there's also opposite situations, you know, as I said, with the Tetris example, where if those people had access to some of the sort of best practices that were available, they had been invented, they just weren't widely known, they could have done better. Instead, they just mostly played the game over and over again. And so I think that tension is sort of like, what are the two roles of learning from other people and learning from practice? I mean, that's a big theme in the book of trying to disentangling what each of those things is doing and where you might need one or where you might need the other.
In the category of learning, are we a bit idealistic in that we think we have so much ability? Like you've talked about the amount of incoming that our memory can handle,
yeah,
and the speed of our processing. Is it more idealized, the ability that can be done versus the reasonable that can be done in over a period of time?
Yeah. There's
something to that.
Well, are you saying, are we overly optimistic about what we can learn, or is that the question?
Yes. Like, okay, what we can learn.
Yeah.
And how far that can go.
So, I mean, it goes both ways. I think my feeling is from talking to people is that people are probably on average, you know, not misinformed. I don't think there's a strong bias towards optimism or pessimism among people. Like if you ask people, like, how long do you think it would take to learn a language, and you just polled random people, and then you compared that maybe to, like, you know, historically on average, how long does it take people to learn a language? I wouldn't expect it to be that different. Like, I wouldn't expect there to be like, well, people think you can learn a language like 10 times faster than it does in reality, or 10 times longer. But what I think is the problematic about that is that there's a lot of variance. So there's probably overly optimistic people and overly pessimistic people. And then also, I think we're kind of bad at making those predictions. So I don't think the issue is like bias that we're like overly optimistic. I think it's just, we just kind of aren't really good at making those predictions in general. So my feeling is that we tend to be better at planning these kind of projects, at self-improvement, the more focused and constrained they are. So the sort of broader the scope of what we're talking about, the bigger it is, I think the worse we are at predicting, just because there's so many details that are unknown when you start a learning project. So for instance, if it's like, I have no programming skill and it's like, okay, I want to be Mark Zuckerberg and like launch a, you know, successful company where I did all like the programming myself. Well, that's going to be very hard to predict. That's going to be very hard to predict even whether it's possible for you, but also just like how long it would take to reach that level of proficiency. Whereas if I were to say, okay, I want to make like a small video game with like Python that's going to, you know, like that's going to play, I don't know, like the game Asteroids or something like that. That's a much more constrained project that, you know, I think you could figure that out. You could talk to a few programmers, figure out, okay, I don't have any skill. Like, how long should I be budgeting for this? What should I have to learn? Like, what is going to be the curriculum? And so I tend to advise, like, all the big projects, all the things that we really want to do that are huge in scope, like becoming a fluent in another language, you know, starting a multi-million-dollar business, becoming the top of our career, you know, being a successfully published academic. All these big goals really are just a lot of these smaller goals stacked together. And so it's helpful to, like, be able to break it down and see, like, okay, what will be the first step? Where would I start? You know, so if I'm going to, like, start a company, okay, well, maybe I got to figure out like how I can register the company, or where maybe I can figure out how I can find my first customer, or this kind of thing. And so once you sort of break the goals down, and so you make self-improvement, or you make the thing that you're trying to get better at smaller, I think we're much better at making those predictions about how long it'll take and what effort will be required.
Effort is a big portion of the element, and there is the quantity versus quality discussion that comes up.
Mm.
And I've always been on the side of quantity and putting out a lot of material and trying a lot. And even if I wasn't the sharpest in some category, that helped me pick up on this piece of feedback or this piece of feedback. Can you speak on quantity leading to the great things? Is it the number of times you do something? Is that the only direction to really focus on?
So, I mean, this was a set. So what you're talking about is I have a chapter. One of the maxims is quality comes from quantity. And this chapter I focused a lot on. Well, I discuss a lot of different theories of creativity, but particularly I lean on the psychologist Dean Simonton. And Dean Simonton has done a lot of work on like creativity historically. So, you know, a lot of psychologists who are studying creativity, they like get people into a lab and like, you know, give them little experiments or like try to come up with, you know, ways you could use this tool. And then they'll like come up with some sort of metric for creativity. But that kind of approach, that sort of experimental approach, I mean, yeah, maybe you can find out something about like how many ideas you generate in a brainstorm, but it doesn't really like, it's not obvious that it has a strong connection with like creativity when we think about, you know, Albert Einstein or Pablo Picasso or someone who has just had world changing impact. So I find Simonton's sort of historically oriented approach where he looks through many, many biographies or many, many examples and draws data from that. So he's not just a biographer. He's drawing data from that and running tests to be very interesting. And so his work, he's drawn a number of different conclusions about the creative lives of eminent individuals. And one of them, which I thought was so surprising and so interesting that like, well, the implications of this, you could write a whole book about, is that there's a very strong tendency for once the sort of initial training period has finished, so you are like at the level where you're now producing, you know, at the top of your field work, the trajectory of people in terms of their like hit rate, whether or not they are, you know, you're getting better and better and better, or you're getting worse and worse and worse, or whatever shape you can imagine your trajectory is relatively flat. And so he finds that it tends to be the case that, well, when you are making a lot of stuff, then that's when you have your hits, because it's not the case that, you know, so like what you were alluding to, which I think is the mindset that I would have had, is that, well, maybe you're getting better and better and better, right? Like maybe you're getting more and more practice attempts, you're getting better. And so each time you do it, you're more likely to have a hit, more likely to have a success. And then there's also people who are maybe somewhat pessimistically have this kind of like youthful genius idea that like you have this spark of genius that like fades out. So you're kind of can't teach an old dog new tricks. And so you're like a revolutionary, and then you're kind of old and outdated. And the thing is he doesn't find either of those patterns. He just finds basically that, well, you know, people's productivity over their career has a certain curve. So people tend to like produce a lot of work, and then that kind of slowly trails off as they get older. And that obviously influences the amount of successes they see. But this equal odds baseline, or this idea that like, you know, for each individual attempt, they have roughly equal potential for having an impact. I mean, I think that's just a profound idea, which is that, you know, once you are at the frontier of a field, once you are producing kind of like that work at the edge of a discipline, there just is a significant random component to what's going to be successful. And so, you know, that's maybe an unavoidable part of being creative.
That part speaks to me a lot because I like that concept. It's like where you live in or where you are in place and making the efforts or making the reach outs, that's where good things will come from, some percentage wise. So wherever you want some sort of success or result, just live there basically.
Yeah.
Or get to that point where it's like a flat, it's your average Tuesday or Thursday, and then that can be the thing where the good things come from, versus it's not really appealing the other way where it just started off and all your successes at the beginning, it's very front loaded. I haven't really seen that to be the case. And then the drop off, that also you're getting more experience, so it shouldn't really drop off that hefty. Yeah.
I mean, it's also one sort of, I guess you could say the flip side of this is that, you know, because Dean Simonton is focused a lot on people who were, you know, eminent enough to make contributions to an elite field. So even if we're not talking about, you know, people at the extreme end of things, you know, if we're talking about people publishing in neurosurgery or something like that, you at least had to reach some level to publish one paper. It's not like some person off the street could do it. And so I do think there is this kind of like training versus performance trade-off too, where, you know, for a lot of us, maybe we just aren't at that kind of elite level in our field. And so, you know, we are still at a level where we could improve, we could get better. But that once you sort of reach this sort of frontier, it seems like being able to do a lot of work and being able to take a lot of chances is a very important factor.
Right. I think about it like a chemical energy curve where the beginning is the activation energy. And if you get past the activation energy hump, and then you can get into this flat zone and you can create and do.
Yeah. And so I mean, I think that's also another metaphor too. Yeah.
It's about like putting yourself there. Speaking of which, I want to point out many of your drawings, I don't know, illustrations showing learning have been super cool. If people would like to check them out, they are all over. They look wonderful, and they showcase a certain kind of learning or a way to visualize how you figure out something. I've enjoyed them, so I want to
give them a shout out there. Yeah, the drawings were a real weird feature because I added it to the blog just really like, because for years I wrote without doing much in the way of illustrations. I've done some illustrations for like some of my self-published ebooks way back in the day and stuff, but it was just like, okay, we needed to get some images, and so I was just like drawing stick figures with marker and pencil crayons on computer paper, and I don't know, people seem to like them, so I keep doing them.
they really speak to the viewer, and they say things that words would not do the same way. The image, you're like, oh, okay, yeah. I'm there in that part of the curve. I can be right there. It takes that. Okay, yeah. Great. But if it was in words.
I mean, I've always felt like I have a visual understanding of things. Like I like language. I am someone who I like to write things and have ideas. But very often you're just like, what I'm trying to express is a picture. And sometimes just writing out a picture just doesn't do it justice. Like you just like, oh, you can just see it, it's there. Whereas if I describe it, it might take a few paragraphs and you're not necessarily going to form the same picture that I have in mind.
That's true. It made me think of, there's this one visualized value person or something. Yours would be visualized learning. So it's like imaging that.
Yeah. That's a cool one. No. I mean, it's definitely a big part of how I think. Yeah.
One thing I've always focused on in life when I look at people is their self-esteem, and also their related to that, their confidence and or fear basis, what they are fearful of, and maybe that holds them back from learning as well. You have a section called Fear Fades with Exposure. Is that true in all categories? Is that true in learning? Can all people reduce the level of fear with which they come at things from by reaching out to them?
Well, so, you know, when I was writing Ultra Learning, this is a number of years ago, a lot of people asked me about emotions and how emotions impacted. And it was something that I definitely wanted to delve deeper into with the subsequent book, because it's very easy to talk about learning at a purely kind of cognitive level where it's like memory and skills and procedures and facts and but, you know, when you talk to people, where their actual difficulties lie are not really so much with that. They're with motivation. They're with, you know, either like that approach motivation, which we kind of already talked about, like building the sort of early successes because you want to be curious, you want to be excited, you want to be passionate about things. But then also what we're talking about now is this avoidance motivation, this kind of like, ooh, I don't want to do that. You know, like that sounds scary. That sounds awful. And I mean, it, quite frankly, for many categories of skill, like that's the main thing. Like public speaking, for instance, the main thing that people struggle with is that people don't like standing on stage and giving speeches. Like that there's a fear involved. With language learning, I mean, I don't want to say it's a central in the same way that public speaking is, but with language learning, like a huge part of it is like, do you feel comfortable just like, okay, I don't speak this language very well, but I'm going to go practice with people that maybe I don't know that well. And maybe I'm going to get negative feedback, but I'm not going to worry about it. Like, can you do that? And if you can't do it, it's going to be hard, right? So So fear, I think, plays such a large role in learning that I really wanted to make sure there was going to be a chapter devoted to it. And the nice thing is that from a neuroscience point of view, fear and threat conditioning and like a lot of these ideas are one of like the better understood areas of psychology. Like we have really good animal models. Like they, you know, an author who really informed a lot of the work on this chapter is Joseph Ledoux. He's a neuroscientist and he wrote a book called Anxious. And he's just done for decades work on like the fear responses and the sort of neural circuitry of this. And like to the point where like you know which neuron synapses on which one, and like that's what's responsible for detecting threats, detecting fears. Whereas a lot of the higher cognitive skills, a lot of the, you know, things that I spend a lot of time talking about in the book, a lot of the detailed mechanisms are still up for debate. A lot of the stuff we don't know. So this particular chapter, the story I open with is about the London Blitz and how psychologists, you know, this is before there was a mass bombing campaign anywhere, predicted that there would just be like terror and panic in the streets. Like they even got police officers. They were like, okay, we want to get police officers to man the metro stations because they're going to be people stampeding to death when they're fleeing when they have the first air raid. And that didn't happen. Actually, you know, despite all the destruction, despite all the, you know, carnage that occurred, people didn't panic. People didn't have this sort of like oversized fear response. And the lesson from that is that exposure, this sort of, you know, hearing the bombs coming, hearing the air raid sirens, but not feeling direct physical injury yourself, not witnessing direct physical injury, tends to, on average, result in lower fear responses over time. And so, you know, toward the end of the Blitz, towards the end of these bombing campaigns, people were kind of, you know, inured to it. They weren't responding. The fear reactions had diminished. And so this basic principle is that a lot of our fears, the origins of our fears, where the fears actually come from, is somewhat complicated and poorly understood. Some of it is maybe innate. You know, we have fears of like spiders, even though probably most of us have never been bitten by a spider before. Very few people have fears of electrical outlets, even though most of us have been shocked before. So it's kind of weird where we develop fears from. Public speaking is an almost universal fear, even if you've never had a bad experience on stage. These sorts of things, like the origins of fears is mysterious. But what we do know is we have a good sense of how learning affects fear. So as you expose yourself to situations where you experience fear, you're experiencing the thing that you're afraid of, but nothing really bad happens, the fear goes down. And you keep repeating this until the fear is effectively suppressed, at least in some of those situations. And so this exposure principle, I think, is really important, not just for illustrating this kind of psychological mechanism of how do you overcome fear, but also I think if you can understand it intellectually, it's easier to approach things that seem daunting, because I think we tend to view our fears or the things that are, you know, scare us as being objective traits of the world. So we just, like, spiders just are scary, or public speaking just is scary. And we neglect the fact that, like, yes, public speaking might be scary for you now, but if you went on a regimen where you were like speaking once a week, you know, after like a couple months, you probably, it wouldn't bother you at all. And so if you can just sort of like make that a hypothetical for yourself, if you know that that's a possibility, I think it's a lot easier to push yourself to do things that maybe scare you in the moment, because you know that if you go through this protocol of exposure for the skills that you're learning, the fear will go down.
I like a lot of what you just described there. You don't want ill-fitting fears to then be cemented, and now for years these things are holding you back when it's not actually connected to the reality that you live in. Interesting one. Now, in the United States, which you're in Canada, but in the United States, the numbers of math and reading that represent people's knowledge, learning in younger people has really dropped off in recent years, and it wasn't already that high, but it's pretty low. Is there something to the effect of the learning environment? Does that affect the individual if the collective around them is learning less or diminished in capacity?
Well, I mean, specifically, not even just America, but in the world in general, I think a lot of the recent decline was very much pandemic related. Not only did you have school closures and this kind of stuff, but a lot of the norms surrounding attendance sort of eroded. And, you know, there's a lot of like hand-wringing kind of think pieces that are coming online right now about how like, oh, well, you know, it used to be the case that, well, you couldn't just pull your kid from school to go on a ski trip. But because of the pandemic, it just kind of became like, oh, yeah, I can just take my kid out whenever I want, or this isn't very important. And so I do think, you know, the very obvious implication of that is that if your kid isn't going to school, they're probably learning less, especially less academic subjects. My thinking is that, you know, the worries about a lot of that is just probably it can be compensated for by just having, you know, if kids return to school, if they're spending more time in school, those numbers will probably improve. Now, the question of like, you know, if they're attending school on a regular basis, how do you get the scores up? How do you get kids to learn more math and science? I think those are big, complicated issues. But definitely, I think the more we can shift towards a model where we're being very clear about what we want kids to learn, and then we're being very kind of systematic about actually teaching it, that's pretty much all the evidence points to that direction for improving those skills. And then there's a bigger discussion we have to have about like what skills we actually want to teach and which ones everyone needs to learn.
That one is talked about quite a bit as of late, maybe before.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, you should add this into the curriculum, or this should be part of what
people learn. I mean, the problem I think is that, like, you know, I spent a lot of time reading research in educational psychology and cognitive science when I was preparing for this book. And one of the things that you just see is a real big lacuna in the research is that the focus is on, okay, given that we want to teach kids, let's say, fractions, you know, what's the best way to do that? And there's many, many different studies investigating various components of that learning process. And there's controversies in the research. I don't want to say that like everything's solved on that end, but there is a lot of ink being spilled. Whereas, you know, philosophical questions about like, okay, well, which skills are most useful to learn? Which, like, is it, should we be teaching kids algebra or statistics? Or should we be teaching them, you know, should we be teaching them handwriting, or should we be teaching them typing? Or like these kinds of trade-offs, I feel like it's not that they're not discussed, it's just that they're not very well researched. And so, you know, probably a better picture of things would be if someone actually could go out in the world, do the cognitive task analyses. I talk about that a little bit in the book, but do this kind of breakdown of like, what are the skills that are actually used in, you know, things that we consider important. And then we could all kind of get together and decide, okay, these are the things that are really essential to being successful and, you know, healthy and a good citizen in our society. And let's teach those. And these things, maybe they're extracurriculars. There may be things that, you know, some kids can learn and some kids don't have to learn. And I think the problem and the real difficulty is that once you get to that level of the discussion, I think it's very hard for people to be objective about it because everyone has their own personal like biases of what they think kids ought to be learning, and you know, and no one wants to be no one wants to have resources stolen away from whatever their pet project is or whatever their pet interest is.
That's true. Each person, the thing that they felt like they didn't get or that they could use right now, we should put that in what
younger I mean, like if you really like chess, it's like very hard to find people that are super interested in chess that don't think we should be teaching kids chess. But I mean, if you look at the research in chess, I feel like it's pretty indicative that mostly what you learn is getting good at chess. So the question is just how important is chess? And, you know, and I think that's true of a lot of other skills. So I think this the objective worth of various subjects, oh, that's just a really political debate. It's hard to have at a level of a democratic society where you're going to just be like, okay, objectively, we need to be teaching this instead of this. I don't think people can think that objectively about it. I think, but I do think that it would be nice to at least have that research to be able to say, oh, actually, you know what, in STEM professions, this set of knowledge is used like 10 times more than this set of knowledge, so maybe we should prioritize it. I would like to have that information, but I just don't think there's that much research on it, unfortunately.
That's a solid point there. My last question here, I once talked with Andrew Stolman. He's at Occidental, and he wrote about imagination connected with learning.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you describe the connection with someone's ability to imagine things and their learning capacity? Is there a connection between the two?
Yeah, I mean, imagination is a broad word, so I'm sure there's probably lots of different ways that you could take that question, but I'm really drawn to the work on mental models. There's a really pioneering psychologist who wrote the book on mental models, Philip Johnson Laird, I believe is his name. And he wrote a lot about how we basically use imagination. Is a sort of maybe a little bit too fanciful a word for it, but basically we use the ability to imagine concrete instances of things, that's the basis of our reasoning ability, our ability to think logically, kind of essentially what makes us smart as a species. And so I think mental models, the ability to simulate some version of reality, to inspect it, to be able to make predictions about it, is pretty key for learning. And a lot of what we're trying to do when we're learning is not acquiring a procedure, not acquiring a set of facts, but acquiring a mental model of whatever the situation is that we're dealing with. I mean, if you're a programmer, having some mental model of how the computer system works is pretty much essential to figure out how to get it to do anything. And so a lot of what I'm trying to do is provide that mental model, provide that kind of imaginative capacity so you can think about how learning works so that you can also move and acquire things in that space. I don't know if that's exactly what you mean by imagination, but to me, that's literally what imagination is that you're simulating some reality in your head.
That's a key one there. I don't know what the name of the book was, something, A Guide to Everything, but somebody else wrote about the five most important growth elements of humans over time, mm-hmm. and one was the ability to imagine or simulate, like you just described.
Yeah.
It has separated us from other species in that way. That's cool. Scott, I would like to thank you for having joined on this discussion, describing a bit from your book that will be out when this goes out, called Get Better at Anything, and informing us a bit about learning and how to grow our learning potential over time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to. And we are out.